We continue our sermon series on anti-heroes this morning with one of my favorites. An anti-hero, of course, is a hero who doesn't possess the, shall we say, more sanitized and flat characteristics of many of the heroes that we might be more comfortable with. Anti-heroes have certainly been alive and well in pop culture in the last several years. We meet Rahab now back in the story in Jericho where we left her. Give me a sign of good faith that you will spare my father and mother, my brothers and sisters, and all who belong to them, and deliver our lives from death, she said. The men said to her, our life for yours. If you do not tell this business of ours, then we will deal kindly and faithfully with you when the Lord gives us the land. Then she let them down by a rope through the window, for her house was on the outer side of the city wall, and she resided within the city wall itself. She said to them, go toward the hill country, so that the pursuers may not come upon you. Hide yourselves there 3 days until the pursuers have returned. Then afterward, you may go your way. The men said to her, we will be released from this oath that you have made us swear to you if we invade the land and you do not tie this crimson cord in the window through which you let us down. And you do not gather into your house your father and mother, your brothers, and all your family. If any of you go out of the doors of your house into the street, they shall be responsible for their own death, and we shall be innocent. But if a hand is laid upon any who are with you in the house, we shall bear the responsibility for their death. But if you tell this business of ours, then we shall be released from this oath that you made us swear to you. She said, according to your words, so be it. She sent them away, and they departed. Then she tied the crimson cord in the window. On the seventh day, they rose early at dawn and marched around the city in the same manner 7 times. It was only on that day that they marched around the city 7 times. And at the 7th time, when the priests had blown the trumpets, Joshua said to the people, shout, for the Lord has given you the city. The city and all that is in it shall be devoted to the Lord for destruction. Only Rahab the prostitute and all who are with her in her house shall live, because she hid the messengers we sent. They burned down the city and everything in it. Only the silver and gold and the vessels of bronze and iron they put into the treasury in the house of the Lord. But Rahab the prostitute, with her family and all who belonged to her, Joshua spared. Her family has lived in Israel ever since, for she hid the messengers whom Joshua sent to spy out Jericho. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church. Maybe. Please pray with me. O God, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of all our hearts be acceptable to you, O God, our rock and our redeemer. Amen. Rahab the prostitute. It's kind of unfair the way that modifier is always attached to her name. Jacob is not continually referred to as Jacob the trickster. Samson's not named Samson the gullible. Eve is not called Eve the tempted. But Rahab gets her name slandered almost every time it appears in Scripture. It is possible that Rahab's line of work didn't seem as negative in her culture or time as it does in ours. A cult of temple prostitution did flourish in a number of ancient religions that elevated that practice to an almost spiritual level. But Israel was characteristically negative on the practice, at least in word. Wages from prostitution were forbidden from being given to the temple. Priests were forbidden from marrying a prostitute or allowing their daughters to become one. So it's hard not to see this repeated refrain as a put-down. At the same time, it is the Israelites in this text who seem a bit, well, less than righteous. The text says that they are on a spy mission, but it's not clear what kind of information they hope to collect at this house of ill repute. They go directly there and spend the night. The only reconnaissance that happens is what Rahab tells them, that the people were afraid when they learned about what happened to other Canaanites who got in the Israelites' way. If Rahab comes off looking bad in this text, then the two Israelite spies are right there with her. It's not even clear why Joshua sent out spies in the first place. God told Joshua that no one would stand in their way of the promised land. When God said the same thing to Moses, and Moses sent spies into the land just to be sure, Moses and the rest were punished for not trusting God. Right here at the beginning of the entry into the promised land, we get the subtle suggestion that the people entering it don't trust God enough to deserve it. And I'm glad for this subtle suggestion that floats its way right into this story at the beginning, because the main storyline of Joshua isn't subtle at all. God has given this land to a specific people, and God has given them the right to burn, pillage, overthrow, and kill to take it by force. They are commanded to annihilate the opposition. That is the main storyline. Carnage is coming, and God has ordained it. God has given the land to a people, and any hesitation to take it could be a sign of their mistrust of God. It is the storyline that we find among all kinds of religiously motivated people today, from right-wing Zionists in Israel who believe God gives them the right to take the land, to hardliners in Iran who believe God gives them the right to wipe Jews from the face of the earth. From terrorists in Syria and Iraq to those who do their evil deeds on our own shores. It wasn't that long ago that Christian crusaders claimed their status as the new Israel gave them the right to do the same. These are some troublesome texts at the hearts of our faith, the ones that are used to justify violence in God's name, except that Rahab finds her way into the heart of this one. It's kind of a shock to find her alive right here at the beginning of Joshua, since the text in Deuteronomy has just commanded the Israelites to wipe out any town where Canaanites are occupying the land. You shall annihilate them, it says, the Hittites and the Amorites, the Canaanites and the Perizzites, the Hivites and the Jebusites, just as the Lord your God commanded, so that they may not teach you to do all the abhorrent things that they do for their gods, and you thus sin against the Lord your God. Rahab is one of those people listed in that text. And yet she lives and goes on living in the land. Her family has lived in Israel ever since, the text says. It makes sense to me that Rahab would be the one who figures out how to survive. Rahab, the prostitute, the Bible won't let us forget. I had a friend once who preached about this line of work that seemed to be so much, that seems to be so much in the news these last several years, the plight of mostly young women, often abandoned by their families or running away from them, with few economic or trusting supports, who find themselves caught up in a trade that puts them at great physical, emotional, and mental risk of abuse, exploitation, or worse. My friend, on the other hand, wrote a paper that was rooted in all the Hollywood-infused stereotypes about women who supposedly choose this line of work. And our professor called him on it. Had he ever spoken to anyone involved in this line of work? No. Did he know why someone would get into this kind of work? No. Did he know how they really felt about it? No. To my friend's credit, he sought out someone in the trade. And like most women caught up in her, like most women caught up in it, her options were limited. Choice would be way too strong of a word. And over a cup of coffee, she told him what her life was like. "You want to know what I think about whenever I'm with a customer?" she asked him. "Well, I think, if he tries to hurt me, can I take him?" She thought about if she would be able to survive. Rahab, you see, like most women in her situation, is a survivor. She doesn't have the privilege of living in a safe world, but she has developed the tools to survive in one. She doesn't have the luxury of living in a secure world, but she's got the street smarts to survive in one. She's not born into a family or a nation or a world that she would ever choose to live in, not as she finds it. But still, she learns how to operate in it, to carve out some safety and security for herself and for her family. And we could judge her for saving only her family. The rest of her town perishes. This is true. Maybe she should have done more in her time. Maybe she could have changed more than just the destiny of her own family. Maybe she should have. History can second guess her just as it will second guess each one of us, and together, the church. The church could have done more to ensure Black Lives Matter in Baltimore. The church could have done more to ensure that education is funded and delivered to bridge the gaps in our times. They could have done more to stop violence against the poor or the LGBTQ community or the exclusion of people with disabilities. Yes, history is right to ask if Rahab should have done more, just as history will ask the same of each one of us and collectively of our church. But Rahab does do more than just save her own family. Rahab's very existence and that of her family undermines God-ordained violence in the Joshua conquest because she proves there can be exceptions to these biblical rules. She opens the door of possibilities for a future for anyone who is named other by our texts, whose exclusion or worse seems explicitly authorized by tradition, text, or ruler. Not all outsiders have to be in opposition to God's plans. Not every text has to be followed through completely to its end. There are more alternatives to be investigated and pursued. There are other possibilities to be attempted. There are more imaginative ends to be sought after. And I find it incredible that her example wins her a starring role, not only in this book that authorizes the destruction of people like her, but in the rest of the Bible, where her faith is never sanitized or separated from her line of work. It is as if the tradition that assembled these stories knew that her experience, even the part of her experience that no one would choose, is what gave her the skills to squeeze as much justice as she could out of the injustice that was delivered to her. Her constricted choices gave her the wisdom to know when and how to push a system that had never and would never benefit her explicitly. We need the faith of Rahab, most especially when the world seems out of God's hands, when the moral arc of the universe doesn't seem to bend toward justice, when violence enacted in God's name seems to have the upper hand. We need Rahab, yes, Rahab the prostitute, who teaches us that some of the most significant acts of faith come from the very people who the church and the culture is afraid to even acknowledge from our pulpits. From people who probably don't even consider themselves all that religious. We need to learn from those who have been through, for example, divorce, and learned what it really means to lean on God's grace when your own love seems to have failed you. We need to learn from those living on public assistance among us who have learned what generosity really means when there's really not that much to share. We need to learn from survivors of abuse or alcoholism or depression who can teach us where true strength and courage comes from and how to reject the church's history of heaping on shame. We need to learn from brothers and sisters who have come out of the closet what it means to choose to accept yourself and love yourself the way that God accepts and loves you. We need to learn from people of color all the slights, the microaggressions, the fear of black bodies in our culture, how to survive it, and how to confront racism and change our future together. We need the Rahabs, not only of the Bible, but of the church today, to teach us how to live in the midst of a world of injustice and bend it a little bit more in the right direction. We need to learn how to not give up hope when the odds are more than stacked against safety in our streets or division across our races or inequality across our wealth and station. We need to learn how to survive in a time where every tweet seems to deliver another bit of news about how governance isn't working in Europe or the Congress, or justice isn't working in the city or in the church. We need the street smarts of Rahab and people just like her. You know, someone once told me here one time that sometimes this person comes to church and looks around and thinks, I don't think I fit here. Everyone seems so successful, they said. You know, I told them, well, obviously you don't know everyone well enough yet. There is plenty of brokenness. There is plenty of struggle to go around. The hard part for all of us is embracing that struggle not as weakness, but as the very well of our strength. That God calls us not in spite of that brokenness, but with it. I wonder who God is calling among us. What person or persons among us this morning who might not even think of him or herself as religious? I wonder who God is calling out of the shadows to teach the church. what it means to hope, what it means to have faith, what it means to hold on. I wonder who God is calling next.